Welcome to another episode of Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine. I'm Shelley Wrench, along with Dr. Nash Gabriel from the Gabriel Cancer Center. And I think that our listeners might have a clue by now that we do a lot of different things. We have our tentacles in a lot of different areas. Research is definitely a large one. And I'd like to let the listeners know what are clinical trials, what is clinical research, what benefits them, what's the cost to it, since this is all about medical economics as well. What are your thoughts?
So, just a piece of history, Shari. I started doing medical research when I was a fourth-year medical school in Iraq. I was just intrigued by phenomena, and I always wanted to study phenomena, but that's mentioned in, I think I mentioned that in my second book, which is The Cancer Gene, how my mind started working that way. But anyway, then when I became academic, when I was teaching at St. Louis University in Missouri, part of it was you do research. I had my own lab. I'll grow bone marrow cells in the culture and play with them. It was like a toy, really. It was like having the Lego game, Lego pieces.
Putting it all together.
I was trying to discover different classes of chemotherapy drugs, how they affect the mother cells. It was an interesting thing. But after 2 years, I just wanted to see more patients, because when you're in academia, you see less patients and more mice or rats if you experiment with those, right? Which really is kind of more fun sometimes because they don't complain. And then I decided to move to community oncology. It took me about 6 years. I was doing some research here and there, but after 6-7 years, I decided that there's something missing in life, and that's to do clinical research, to be part of the process. And seriously also, I thought it would be also, I always thought of competition that I have to compete with whoever is the best. To me, that's competition.
Do you think that comes from the Assyrian side of you?
My heritage?
Yeah.
Well, my dad was like that.
Yeah.
I think it's genetic.
Yeah.
Competitive is good, by the way, it's good.
Oh, it is good. Yeah.
I do know my kids, especially my two boys, are very competitive. And, you know, they do very well in business anyway. So I decided in 1999 that I want to be part of the drug development program. That when the drugs are being experimented on, I want to be one of the people who try those drugs on my cancer patients. Part of it was, I was almost disgusted by what we have available. Almost, it was a monotony. Every patient comes, Taxol, Carbo, Carbo, Taxol, Cisplatin.
So you were looking for something outside the box.
Big time outside the box. Plus, I did know that a lot of those drugs under development, one day they'll be approved. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice that my patients
benefited?
Will get drugs.
Way before.
About 5 years before they're available in the market to everybody else. Wouldn't that be nice? Plus, I think we human beings, especially those of us who are driven, we need to be kept on our tiptoes. And when you do research, you are on your tiptoes. There are zillion eyes watching you. Doing clinical trials is really fun, but it comes with a price.
Zillion eyes watching you or watching the patient?
Both. Both.
Yeah, so that's why clinical research patients actually do better.
The fact that somebody is watching my staff and myself translates into
better outcomes.
Better outcomes that we are watching the patients. We have to watch the patients super, super carefully. We have to document everything. If they burp, we document. If they fart, we document. If it smells, we document.
And who grades the smell?
Who grades the smell? Yeah. We have a grading system for everything.
Yeah.
Really. So when you say patient got sick like nausea, that's not enough. There is grade 1, 2, 3, 4 nausea, and you have to learn those. Fortunately, there is now in the electronic medical records, you click somewhere and you get that grading system.
Right.
Same with our staff, my research staff. When I said the patient got nausea grade 2, they go there and verify that indeed it was a grade 2, and they put it there because somebody, the FDA, the drug company, the clinical research organization, all these people will come and look at the patient's charts and verify every single thing we said.
And what do they, what are the monitors that come in on a regular basis? What do they say about our practice?
Well, Shelley, as you know, we have won 5 national awards for best in community research, including nomination to be the for the best in clinical research by ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. I mean, everybody nationwide, they know that if there is any practice who does real comprehensive clinical research, it's Gabriel Cancer Center. I mean, that's really a fact that everybody knows, so much so that we have patients who get referred to us from other states. In fact, even regional academic centers, they pick up the phone and refer patients to us because we have complex clinical trials that take them maybe 4 or 5 months to initiate and organize at the big centers, while with us, we have a little bit more agile system. We open the trials quickly.
Don't you think as well, though, it's easier to open up a clinical trial at a practice that has one decision maker rather than 40 decision makers?
Yeah. Dr. Vincent DeVita, he's my opinion, the founder of modern oncology, and he's also the author of our Bible in oncology called The Principles and the Practice of Oncology. Vincent DeVita, he was the head of the National Cancer Institute. I mean, the guy's accomplished. He wrote a book about 2 years ago, him and his daughter. The title of the book was The Death of Cancer. And in that book, it was very, very enlightening how what he thought about cancer, what he thought, by the way, he's fighting cancer himself, what he thought about the process. And one of the things he mentioned was at Yale University, where he retired from, to open, those are clinical trials very seriously. To open a clinical trial at Yale required 27 signatures and average 5 months.
Wow.
Now remember, when drug company come to us and they say, we want a phase 1 trial, usually they want it done within 6 months.
Explain what a phase 1 trial is.
Phase 1 trial is the clinical trial where you get a drug that has been shown to be safe and effective in our cousins, the rats. We're nice to monkeys, rats and mice. So when you discover that, the next step would be to go and try it on humans to see whether it actually have a chance to work. That's a phase 1.
Okay.
And they are complex trials. I mean, we do a lot of phase 1 trials for one reason, that is we have very dedicated, knowledgeable, accurate staff.
Oh, we have the A-team in research.
We have, I call them the Navy SEALs.
Yeah.
Unbeatable. The best. And that's what you need, because this is not an area where you can afford errors.
So what is the benefit for patients for phase 1 clinical trials versus any other phase? Is there a benefit or is there not a benefit?
There are times where the results from phase 1 trial will get FDA approval.
Oh, like a fast track?
Fast tracking. So in the old days, it used to be a phase 1 shot in the dark. Like you had this chemical brought from the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, weed, whatever, and you extract the chemical, and you tried on all the different kinds of cancers, because generally in those days, those chemicals, they only work on dividing DNA.
Or it was more like a shotgun approach.
Shotgun approach.
Yeah.
Which means the chances for a phase 1 to have shown benefit was not there. It really wasn't there. Now we have more custom designed drugs.
Targeted, right? Not the targeted?
The targeted is custom designed. So the targeted, exactly. Targeted, you know there is this gene mutation, and you go to the computer and you have the 3-dimensional structure of that gene, and you create a chemical to 3-dimensional to block it and tell the chemist, now you make it. I worked for a long time with a lady. She's actually from Israel. She's a PhD, and her PhD was in electronic physical chemistry. Currently, she owns a drug company, her and her husband. Very bright lady. But that's how we do things. So when you have that gene mutation that's unique for disease A, it is natural that you try your designed drug on disease A, which is also natural that this is better than a shotgun approach.
Right. I was just thinking recently I discovered that on the 23andMe, the kit for the genetics, that they could identify the potential risk of Alzheimer's. How do they do that? I mean, that's not using the medicine, determining what medicines to be used.
That's a different story, though. How do you do that? Yes. The best way to learn about this is to read a book. I love reading. There's a book called My Life Decoded. The author, his name is Greg Venter. Not Greg, Craig Venter. Greg Venter is a scientist from San Mateo, California, who actually mapped the human genome few months before the Human Genome Project was accomplished. The Human Genome Project was funded by the government in the 90s. I think Bill Clinton was the one who, $3 billion, right, distributed to zillion labs. This guy, Venter, he did it alone with some private venture capitalist money, $125 million.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And he wanted to release the information. Bill Clinton called him to the White House and said, you cannot do that. You will embarrass the government. So he delayed until the government finished their project and then they announced together. Well, Greg Venter talks about this. One of the things he mentions, actually he started a company now in South Africa. He mentions the fact that he has congenital prolonged QT syndrome. QT is a little electronic dimension of your EKG in the heart.
Right.
And you know what it is. And that's a genetic thing. And we know what the gene is for that. So currently, instead of doing EKG to every family member in that family, you can actually look for that gene. There are also genes that predict the early onset of Alzheimer's disease. Thanks to all the research being done. So you go and look into 1,000 people who have developed Alzheimer's disease at a young age. Remember, when people get Alzheimer's disease in the 80s, usually that's more, we call it multi-infarct dementia. It's more tiny little strokes. So when you look at the genetic makeup for those people, it's a very complex process. You actually can identify genes that are associated with that. Generally speaking, those genes are associated but not dogmatic, not foolproof. I give you, there is a blood disease called hemochromatosis. There are 7 genes known to be associated with hemochromatosis. What does associate mean? Meaning, actually, if you have one of those genes mutated, you are more likely than others to have hemochromatosis.
Gotcha.
We haven't become it's not clean yet, but it's advancing so quickly. Now, in cancer, we're doing a little bit quicker because in cancer, we go directly to the cancer cell and look at the genetic makeup. And currently, there is a company that will run 350 genes in one sitting to identify any mutations and match if we have drugs that match the mutation.
And all those different mutations, do we have drugs to actually take care of those?
No, very few drugs. But for somebody like me, I'm experimenting in our center. We are experimenting with 50-plus new drugs that are not available in the market. When we see those genes, that can be a signal, okay, this patient might qualify for that clinical trial. But a lot of the trials we're doing also, they don't have to be tied to a gene or gene mutation.
Right. So how do patients know that, number one, they should look into clinical trials? Number two, how do they find who's doing real meaningful clinical trials?
I think we talk about these things all the time, that we can always blame the system. There are a lot of people who blame the system, blame the government, that clinical trials are not well advertised, I always go back to the same concept. Individuals have the right and maybe obligation to be their own advocates.
Well, the government has the clinicaltrial.gov right. website. It's not the easiest thing to navigate through, but it does have all the information there.
It is. It's one of the few good things that the government does. So to know if there are clinical trials available, and believe me, for every cancer, there are at least 40, 50 clinical trials available. Currently, there are about 3,600 clinical trials, or 36,000. I mean, the number is astronomical. So how do you navigate through that maze?
Before that, though, I mean, how do the patients know that if I choose to look for a clinical trial, I'm actually going to get something that could potentially benefit me versus those clinical trials that may not be approved by the FDA that more is like the old style guinea pig type clinical trials?
Here's the deal, Shelley. Nobody goes on a clinical trial that runs the risk of a compromise on their health, because if there is, when we design a clinical trial, we make sure that the new drug is either added to what is normally used.
The standard of care.
Okay. Or compared to it. So nobody gets...
Is that only true in our center or...
Oh, it's nationwide.
Nationwide. So they're protected.
I generally minimize the number of trials that include placebo. Not because I don't like placebo. I think there are trials where you need a placebo. Generally, those are phase threes. In our center, we are... We do
and phase three is because it's already shown to be effective and we already have the standard dosing. It's basically to show one drug is better than the other. Is that a phase?
Correct.
Yeah, so I totally get it.
Or better than nothing.
Right.
So a phase three can be drug X versus drug X plus the experimental drug.
Right.
So you still get the drug X. And sometimes for logistical reasons, you say blood X plus placebo, drug X versus, plus placebo versus drug X plus the experimental drug.
Gotcha.
But more, about 70% plus, 80% of our clinical trials at Gabriel Cancer Center are phase one and phase two. And generally those are the early stage ones. And actually those are the ones that are more exciting because that's where the real new discovery happens.
So let's go into the economical side of clinical research for patients.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is more my part, because I think that a lot of people think, as soon as they come into the center, they say, you know, is my insurance going to cover this? And yes, insurances cover the standard of care in clinical trials, but what they don't understand is the experimental drug itself definitely is not standard of care. It's paid for and given to us to be administered to the patient for free. So it's only if you would have regular blood draws or regular CAT scans, that kind of stuff, the insurance pays for that while you're on the clinical trial. It's only if you would have a CAT scan every week or, you know.
But the bottom line is, at the end of the day, I believe you'll agree with this, Shelley, that if you are on a clinical trial compared if you were on the standard of care, your cost and the cost of your insurance is much lower.
Oh, vastly lower.
Because number one, the experimental drug is for free. Number right. two, some of the testing needed mm-hmm. is also included in the cost. Like when we do the genetic testing, that is not charged to your insurance. But we don't do that because it's cheaper for patients. No, I mean, when you're fighting cancer, you know, I don't care about the cost. We do it because it is the best thing to do for patients.
Right.
Back to your question about how do patients know about them. So clinicaltrials.gov is a nice website. You said it's not easy to...
Yeah, it's a little daunting, but once you get used to it, I mean, you can navigate. But it's not, I don't think it's written at a junior high level, right? Meaning that it should be a little bit more...
User-friendly?
User-friendly and a little bit more explanatory on a lower grade.
.gov, right?
Yeah.
So you're expecting the government to do
to
something,
do something right?
User-friendly?
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
I don't think so.
No, yeah. But it is a good website nonetheless.
At least you can find the places that are doing clinical trials for specific diseases, and then they can contact them and find out more.
Once in a while, I go into the website just to be nosy and see what's going on and stuff. And it's, I mean, you have to really spend some time to realize you look for a disease site, like you have cancer of lung cancer, you go into lung cancer and you start looking into clinical trials, and it shows you all the clinical trials. And of course it shows you the titles of the clinical trials, and you might need some help with that, but a lot of the people are learning more and more. So a lot of people, they want immunotherapy or targeted therapy. And then you pick and choose, maybe this trial. And then you click on it. And if you want to know if there is a center close to you or what is the closest center, I think you put your area code, zip code.
Zip code, yeah.
Zip code, and that shows you. Remember, a lot of these trials, Shelley, the phase 1-2, there will be only 5 centers nationwide.
Well, think about when we did the immunotherapy trials. That was how many years ago? And explain what that actually, what kind of therapy that is, the immunotherapy.
The immunotherapy is basically making your immune system fight your cancer. It just happens, and in fact, by the way, there are 4 or 5 drugs approved for immunotherapy, and we are experimenting with about 11. What we're doing, let me explain what we're doing. When cancer starts, there's something, a term we call it mutational burden, meaning how much genetic alteration has happened in the cancer cells. The more genetic alteration, the more these cancer cells become unlike normal cells, which means the more likely it is that the system, the immune system, will recognize them as foreign. That's why early stage cancers,
they're not foreign enough.
Right. They thrive. And by the time they grow, when they grow to stage 4 and they acquire so many mutations, when you reach that stage, the patient has lost so much weight, the immune system is knocked down. So although the mutation burden is high and the immune system recognizes it as foreign, there are just, the immune system is running out of ammunition. That's basically what it is.
Wow.
So what we're discovering now is kind of fascinating thing, what I learned about 3-4 years ago. When we give chemo to patients, like you give a patient, have lymphoma, you give them chemo and they respond. And then after 1 year comes back, you give chemo again, less chances to respond. You give chemo again, even less chances. Why? Because every time the cancer comes back, it has acquired more mutations, meaning it has become less, even less similar, more foreign.
And more resilient.
Exactly. Those mutations make the cancer cells resilient and they kick out chemo drugs from the cell. In fact, we call P glycoprotein. It's a pump. They acquire this multi-MDR, multi-drug resistance. Now, what we discovered was when you give immunotherapy, when you give it to those early stage ones, it still works, but it doesn't work as well as it works in the later stage, when there is more mutation. Generally, there is some variations. I also believe that immunotherapy actually works better when the tumor burden, you know, these are terms we use.
Right.
The tumor burden is actually how many pounds of cancer there is in the system. The more there is, the less likelihood you respond. Why? Well, I mean, military analogy is always something I thrive on.
Yes.
So if you have a fortress, right, and you want to bomb it, you need a lot of bombs, right? And if you have only a few bombs left, or if the fortress is very, very big, you'll be not as effective. So if you have 2 kilo or 2-3 pounds or 4 pounds of cancer in the system, and if your immune system is kind of struggling, yeah, you will have a dent, but not big enough even to see it by CAT scan. So what we're doing now, we have about 8-9 clinical trials. We say, okay, we need to do 2 things. Number one, strengthen the immune system, because we know it's getting weaker and weaker. How do you strengthen it? There are many ways. One of them is, like one trial we're doing, there's a chemical called interleukin-10. Interleukin-10 lives in the circulation for a fraction of a second. But during that fraction of a second, it stimulates the immune cells to divide. So what do? We can make it, but by the time you give it back, it disappears. So somebody brilliant took that molecule and added to polymer, polymer-like antifreeze. When you add it to polymer and you inject it under the skin...
So you're putting antifreeze inside of people?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's not antifreeze. It's kind of similar to antifreeze. Yeah. Not big dose, you know. Not enough even to thaw your windshield. So when you inject that subcutaneously, you know, there are drugs that already do that. They start releasing the interleukin-10 gradually over a period of several hours. That constant stimulation of the T lymphocytes to grow and multiply. So although the immune system was weakened, we are actually trying the best to augment it.
Now, there are a lot of side effects with that?
There's always side effects.
Well, I mean, I guess I
would... The main side effect of that one is blood count can drop.
But the side effects is like versus chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, you lose your hair, you lose, you know.
No hair loss, no nausea, no vomiting, or little nausea, vomiting. This is a good question, Shelley, because we are changing not only the natural history of diseases, we are also changing the patient's quality of life with these therapies.
The face of cancer is what we're really changing.
I think we are. And you know what? There's nothing more thrilling than being just at the tip of the bayonet and doing all this work. People do CMEs by going to conferences. You know, the conferences I go to are all these meetings where you get the PhDs, the weird guys, right? And they give you all that information. So, wow, awesome. And then the scientific ones and the medical ones. I think that's the one reason why the word retirement doesn't enter into my vocabulary.
And it shouldn't. You're doing too many great things.
I try. It kind of makes life more meaningful when you do stuff. There are challenges and there is, you know, but it's amazing world.
All coming from when you first started being inquisitive back in Iraq in, what, fourth grade? You've come a long way.
Fourth year medical school, not fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
No, I actually, the first thing I did was I studied.
You weren't quite as inquisitive in fourth grade.
My curiosity was, why is it that there aren't as many miscarriages in women who have the Rh negative, Rh positive? Why isn't less than what the statistics will prove? I did a study on that when I published a paper. It was kind of a landmark for even the hematologists. Wow. It was all based on statistical analysis of whatever.
Well, again, it's been another great episode. Thank you.
Thank you.